they're looking to attract young people who are amped up on violence and who see this group going even further than Al-Qaeda did.
The latest video from ISIS is a viral ad directed at the sociopath demographic. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Also going viral, the measles.
You ask any mother in the autism community, we'll take the flu, the measles, over autism any freaking day of the week. So I think they need to wake up and stop hurting our kids.
And remember the nightmarish photos from Abu Ghraib? There are thousands more the government is withholding for fear, it claims, of violent repercussions.
There's something extremely disturbing about the idea that our government should be able to use the prospect of violence overseas in order to suppress evidence of its own misconduct.
All that and a sincere apology after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Pounding by bombers and a push by Kurdish forces, ISIS militants this week were at last driven out of the Syrian city of Kobani. ISIS was not, however, driven out of the realms of fear and revulsion.
A newly released video showing a Jordanian pilot held hostage since December, caged and then burned alive.
A highly produced ISIS video depicting the burning alive of Jordanian pilot Mowath al-Kasasbi horrified the world, somehow eclipsing the now familiar on-camera beheadings that have propelled the jihadi fanatics into global infamy. Some commentators have surmised that the propaganda may have finally turned on the propagandists, but not necessarily. Borsu Daragahi, who covers the Mideast for the Financial Times, says ISIS knows who it wishes to repel and who it wishes to attract, and how to do both at once.
Well, I think it was the graphic nature of the execution in itself, the aestheticization of the killing of this pilot. Not just the fact that he was an Arab, but the fact that this killing was depicted with high-definition video, with sound effects and digital effects that made it resemble scenes from a horror movie. And I think the effect of that was what the people who had made this movie expected. It horrified people, it shocked people, and it pierced through a kind of layer of numbness that has taken hold of the Arab world over the last dozen years of invasion, revolution, and extreme repression that has all been caught very graphically on live streaming video, put on satellite television, and more recently on the internet. This has pretty much immunized people against some of the violence that's taking place in the region.
There has been some speculation that the particular revulsion attendant to this episode has to do with, on the subject of being inured, how commonplace a beheading is even in the regular criminal justice system in parts of the Arab world, especially the Gulf states. Were previous videos regarded as just kind of punishment as usual?
In part, I think yes, because beheadings have become kind of sadly common throughout the Arab world, both by certain governments, very few actually, and by these insurgent groups over the years. I think it's also very important to note that the target audience for these, let's call them jihadi snuff films, it's not at all mainstream Arabs. It's a certain kind of disaffected, disillusioned, somewhat literate, very media savvy types of people. And those are the potential recruits for ISIS. And I think this is one of the reasons why so many of ISIS's fighters are not just coming from the Arab world, but even second generation immigrants to the West are finding a certain appeal here.
Is this a case of just trying to go to the basest, most morbid, most antisocial instincts of the bottom of the barrel?
I think to some extent it is. I think there's also a lot of noise out there. There's a lot of different forces competing for the attention of people in the media, on the streets, in the mosques. And this is a way for ISIS to eclipse the noise coming from other corners of the internet and of the media. I mean, I hate to say this, there's a certain kind of punk rock appeal to what these guys are doing, what some analysts have called jihadi cool.
The idea of competition among various jihadist groups for the hardest cases out there, you know, it's on the verge of being comical. It sounds like something out of a Mel Brooks movie or something like that.
Actually, there's a movie called Four Lions. It's a British dark comedy about four Muslims in the UK. And these guys are like the biggest idiots in the world, you know, just a real bunch of losers. And it tells their story about how one of them goes to Afghanistan and accidentally fires off a weapon and kills the jihadis who are supposedly hosting him.
ISIS requires some level of credibility and sympathy. It is, after all, based on supposedly an Islamic framework. And if it is to be Islamic, can it go out there and, you know, just try to recruit the biggest misfits and sociopaths and still be in any way taken seriously by the Muslim world in whose name it is doing what it's doing?
I would say that it is not doing what it's doing in the name of the mainstream Muslim world right now. It, in fact, is rebelling against the mainstream Muslim world. There's no shortage of people who are rather contemptuous of its ideology. Just to give one example, no one calls it ISIS or al-Dawla, al-Islamiyya in Arabic in this part of the world. Everyone calls it Daesh, which is a rather derogatory term that uses the old Arab acronym for the group. And they refer to it in that way on talk shows, in conversations on the street, and so on. So I don't think there's a lot of respect for this group's ideology.
If the Muslim world, as you've described, been in some ways anesthetized by its travails there, lo, the last 12 years, if not 50, Arab forces are certainly making progress on the battlefield against ISIS forces. ISIS has lost territory in both Syria and Iraq. Is this the last desperate act of a movement that is in its last days?
I wish we could say that, but I don't think so. I think that they still have some momentum. They still control Mosul. They still control Raqqa. It's a war of attrition in Syria and in Iraq, despite the fact that they lost Kobani, in part due to perhaps a dozen U.S. and other airstrikes a day that helped the Kurdish forces take Kobani. So if that's what it's going to take for every little town in this territory, this is going to be a long war. But I think that if you want to look at the big picture, what this video means for people is that I do think it will serve as a wake-up call for any people who thought that they could perhaps sit this war out, that ISIS doesn't affect them, that it's not that great of a danger to them. I think that this will alert a lot of people, not just in Iraq and Syria, who are already aware of the danger of ISIS, but perhaps in Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, other Arab countries, just what a danger this group is.
Borzu, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Borzu Daragahi covers the Mideast for the Financial Times in Cairo. If an act of terror falls in the desert and nobody is there with a video cam, is it terrifying? Bruce Hoffman is the director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. He believes that horror over the burned alive video is exactly the point, and has been the point through a hellish string of atrocities. Warning, disturbing details just ahead.
It's no different than degradations they've inflicted on Christians who they've crucified, or Yazidi children whose heads they've lopped off and put on spikes, or women who they've chained to two pickup trucks that take off in the opposite direction. I think the problem is they're deliberately out to provoke us, and they want to get this attention. And in fact, they want King Abdullah to respond exactly as he has, by ratcheting up this struggle. Don't forget, when they paraded this really unfortunate pilot before the cameras, they took him to a scene of a previous coalition bombing. And indeed, just before he himself is burnt to death, there's scenes of fighters, but also children, being pulled out of the rubble of a bombing. So they see this cycle of violence is enabling them to claim this mantle of true believers defending their people against this predatory, aggressive, religiously corrupt enemy.
If ISIS is trying to draw parallels to what it deems to be atrocities from other Arab states and from the West, in order to impress a Muslim constituency, it doesn't seem to be doing a very good job of that. The outrage in the Arab and Muslim worlds this week has been loud and apparently near universal.
Yes, that's entirely true, but those aren't the people they're trying to recruit or trying to influence. right-thinking people, middle, upper-middle class, middle-aged, older people, that's not the demographic they're looking to appeal to. That's precisely who's horrified by this. They're looking to attract young people who are amped up on violence and who see this group going even further than Al-Qaeda did, for example, and really sticking it to the West, sticking it to what they see as corrupt regimes like the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, and not coincidentally, who they see as being effective. Effective, firstly, in projecting a compelling message. I'm not defending the message, it's a horrific message, but nonetheless, the people they're targeting, that's catnip to them. And the fact that they have been able to, in essence, redraw the map of the modern Middle East, which no country really has been able to do since World War I, has given them a certain credibility and gravitas, and I think created this absolutely horrific sense of hubris, but nonetheless, the sense that they can push the envelope and still survive.
So there is an ongoing battle, not only against the West and against mainstream Islam, but against other jihadi groups for recruits to wage the struggle for a caliphate. And their goal is to just impress as many alienated, impotent, violent, adventure-seeking morons as they can before Al-Qaeda in Yemen gets to them, for example.
I would argue that it's precisely this intense rivalry and competition between mainstream or core Al-Qaeda and its far more radical offshoot, ISIS, who after all was expelled from the parent group, that in fact is behind a lot of these absolutely horrific acts of violence. They're competing for the same demographic. And at the end of the day, in terrorism, the coin of the realm is violence. And I think for many of these individuals, this isn't an ideological struggle. The ideology doesn't matter as much as, I would argue, the feeling of satisfaction and the cathartic rush that one gets from what they see is striking a blow against some hated enemy.
So how does the West and how do America's Arab allies deal with them as a continuing criminal enterprise, as a political movement, as a group of heavily armed religious zealots? Should episodes like the burning of the Jordanian pilot in any way inform the reaction of government apart from instinctive revulsion?
I mean, you've put your finger on the problem. They're all those things you describe, which means there's no one approach that will work given that diversity. I think the response is, bottom line, is they have to be eliminated. They are not an entity that can be negotiated with, or I would argue even contained, because they're always trying to sort of go beyond the bounds of what we even expect. What we need is a coherent strategy that addresses all those different facets you name. It's also responding to them in a strategic and long-term manner rather than falling into the trap that they set to elicit an emotional response. We have to react in a way that not only weakens them immediately, but systematically dismantles and destroys them over time.
If at bottom this latest video, like its predecessors, was an attempt to impress the sort of grisly jihad, what if there were videos that portrayed those people as suckers?
I think those types of counter-messaging are enormously essential to break the cycle of recruitment and regeneration that has really sustained ISIS from its earliest days to its current embodiment. It's also, I think, enlisting the victims of terrorism to show that the ideologies and the theological justifications that are being used are false and cynical ones. But it's something that has to, I think, be crafted on multiple levels. It can't be just one message. We have to overwhelm them with effective counter messages the way they overwhelm us with their highly graphic depictions of violence.
Although the U.S. government historically has been just laughably terrible, and every time one of those ham-fisted propaganda efforts pops up, we point and laugh. Do you have any confidence that anyone in the administration or in the Pentagon can produce such counter-messaging without making themselves look like fools?
You're right to cite the very uneven efforts over the past decade and a half. But two things. One, we did do this, and we did do this very well when we had a U.S. information agency during the Cold War. So it can work, but it's got to be properly resourced. And that's the second point. At a time when we're more financially constrained than we were, for instance, 14 years ago at the start of the war on terrorism, And those constraints and our obsession with metrics means that everything we do has to somehow be quantifiable. So it's easy to say how many Al-Qaeda senior leaders we've killed in drone attacks. It's easy to say how many sorties U.S. aircraft have flown against ISIS and how many fighters we believe that these bombing raids have killed. It's much harder to put a number, or it's even impossible to measure, that you've stopped someone from being radicalized or going overseas to become a foreign fighter. So I think the key is we would do better and they would be more effective if they were given much more of a priority than they've been accorded throughout the entire war on terrorism.
Bruce, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bruce Hoffman is the director of the Center for Security Studies and director of the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. Coming up, thanks to the media, the measles goes viral. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hi, this is Meredith from TLDR. This week, Amelia Greenhall explains how the go-to pundit on women in tech came to be a man.
Any time women in tech are being discussed, he's there like bursting in like the Kool-Aid man being like, I have opinions.
You can hear that episode when you go to iTunes and subscribe to TLDR or wherever you do your listening. Remember, there are 45 episodes now, so get them all.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. While the photos from Abu Ghraib, notably a hooded man hooked to an electric wire, still linger in America's consciousness, those who've seen this secret cache of photos say they're even more disturbing, and therefore potentially inflammatory. The American Civil Liberties Union has been battling with the government to release the pictures since 2004, immediately after the first Abu Ghraib images were leaked to the press. Jamil Jaffer, deputy legal director of the ACLU, says the Obama administration agreed to release the photos in 2009, but then Congress got involved.
That was all set to happen, but Senators McCain and Graham and Lieberman introduced legislation to give the Secretary of Defense some authority to retroactively carve out photographs like this from the scope of the Freedom of Information Act. In the wake of the passage of that legislation, the administration essentially changed its mind and said, you know, we now have new authority to withhold the photos and we're going to withhold the photos. And the case was sent back to the district court, to the same judge who had originally ordered the photos release, and we have been litigating before that judge for the last few years.
The rationale for withholding the images is and has always been that they are so incendiary that they could endanger Americans abroad and also national security in general.
Right. That's essentially the argument that the Bush administration made and now the Obama administration is making, is that these photographs could be used as propaganda, could complicate diplomatic relationships, and could provoke violence against American troops and American civilians. You know, obviously, those aren't arguments that anyone should easily dismiss. But on the other hand, you could make those kinds of arguments about a lot of information that's been released over the last decade, including the CIA black sites and Guantanamo. And if you sort of accept the principle that the government can withhold information whenever the release of the information would be incendiary, there's no reason to believe that that kind of principle could be limited to photographs like this. You know, the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, on an almost daily basis, contains descriptions of American policies that could be provocative to some of our enemies. You can't adopt a rule that says Americans get to know only the information that's not provocative to anybody. I mean, that would be a crazy rule to adopt, but that's sort of the rule that the administration is proposing.
And in fact, as you have observed, the administration is talking out of both sides of its mouth on this very question. In reacting to the Charlie Hebdo murders in Paris and the apparent North Korean hack of Sony over the film The Interview, the administration has enunciated very clear lines against censoring free speech because somebody might be offended.
You know, everybody said, we are Charlie Hebdo, right? Essentially, people said the same thing in connection with the North Korea hacks, that we shouldn't let some dictator dictate which movies get seen here in the United States. And I think that's exactly the right response. But it does seem jarring then to read the administration's briefs in a case like this one involving the torture photos, where the administration essentially says that terrorists across the world are going to dictate what Americans get to see relating to their own government. These photos are about what took place in military detention centers in our names. There's something extremely disturbing about the idea that our government should be able to use the prospect of violence by others overseas in order to suppress evidence of its own misconduct or misconduct by government agents. You know, we do have at this point quite a lot of textual evidence relating to the abuses that took place, but the photos should be a crucial aspect of the public record.
The notion, although it has long since been impeached by textual evidence that you're describing, I think persists that Abu Ghraib was a few bad apples, a few enlisted people and non-coms who, you know, zealously and maybe pathologically exceeded their authority. What these pictures demonstrate, because they were taken at a number of sites around the Mideast and Central Asia, is that this was policy.
That's right. And if they show patterns of abuse, I think that they would corroborate the theory that the abuse was, at least to some extent, the result of policy decisions. I think maybe even more important, the photographs would humanize the prisoners. We talk about things like, for example, the ticking bomb hypothetical, you know, which has really got, in my view, much more airtime than it deserves. But those kinds of hypotheticals are from the realm of the abstract. And if you have a photograph showing a prisoner who's actually in a stress position or a hooded prisoner, people will inevitably understand better what it actually meant to adopt these kinds of policies. If you think of the photographs of the concentration camps after World War II, or the photos of civilians fleeing from napalm bombing, or even the Eric Garner video here in New York, or the Rodney King video from LA, these kinds of visual images are what have provoked policy changes.
The occasion for this conversation is a federal judge's ruling which may finally yield the release of these photos. What's going to happen next?
We had a hearing on Wednesday before the district court, the same judge who ordered the release of the photographs in 2005. And he has essentially given the government 1 week to justify the withholding of the photos on an individualized basis. In other words, they have to go through this whole stack of 2,000 photos and tell the judge, why does this one have to be withheld? And that's something that the government has resisted. So we are expecting that the judge will order the government to release the photos, and the government will then be confronted with a question of whether to appeal. We're still hopeful that the government will change its view.
Getting back to the government's rationale for withholding these images, let's just say it isn't fear of embarrassment or prosecution. Let's just say it is just a genuine fear of violence. It's not an insane worry. Even in the ISIS beheading videos where the victims are made to wear orange jumpsuits, that is a direct reference to the orange jumpsuits that the detainees at Guantanamo Bay are wearing. It is exactly the kind of violent retribution that the government fears, no?
You're right, but would it be better if we didn't know that the detainees had been mistreated at Guantanamo? Would it be better if we hadn't seen the original Abu Ghraib photographs? You know, I think that we often think of secrecy as some evil that the government perpetrates on the citizenry. It can also be a tool that we use consciously or subconsciously to protect ourselves from knowledge that is inconvenient. At some level, people don't want to confront what's in these photos. They might require us to think more seriously about what should be done or what should have been done in response to abuses of this kind. The Obama administration and before that the Bush administration, they've consistently argued in court that the victims of these policies shouldn't have an opportunity to bring civil cases. They have not charged any senior official with any crime. There's been no effort to rehabilitate prisoners who were tortured or even to acknowledge the names of the prisoners. There's a kind of collective denial that's going on. And our hope would be that the release of photos like this would force us to confront things that we have been reluctant to confront until now.
Jamil, many thanks.
Thank you.
Jamil Jaffer is Deputy Legal Director of the ACLU and Director of its Center for Democracy. This week, finally, reality began to dawn. Not quackery, urban myth, and belief, but physiology and contagion and sickness.
Now to the latest on the measles outbreak. The government says 102 people are infected across 14 states now. And the American Academy of Pediatrics is urging families to vaccinate their children against the disease.
Measles outbreak, the biggest in years and traced back to Disneyland.
The measles outbreak spreads to a fifth Bay Area county. One local pediatrician accuses vaccination opponents of undermining a basic survival concept.
Yes, they did, which is why this outbreak was literally inevitable. The measles, mumps, rubella vaccine had essentially eradicated those childhood diseases in the United States. But when parents began to stop vaccinating their kids, they were creating not just potential patients, but vectors spreading the disease to the vulnerable, such as the baby's pre-vaccination age infected this week in a Chicago daycare center. And whose fault is all of this? Well, mainly, it's the media's fault. The nightmare began in 1998 when a British con man named Dr. Andrew Wakefield faked results and published an article in the prestigious medical journal The Lancet fraudulently claiming a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. It was a lie, which the journal should have figured out long before finally retracting the article 12 years later. By then, the bogus linkage had already spawned a movement of heartbroken parents struggling to understand what or who was to blame for their children's afflictions. Trading as it was on the counterfeit currency of pseudoscience, that movement first languished as a relatively obscure internet subculture, until it was given vast exposure and lethal credibility by the media. The likes of Larry King and Oprah simply could not resist the apparent controversy, combined with the celebrity of the anti-vaccinators' sexpot spokesperson, Jenny McCarthy. Here she was on CNN in 2012.
So you ask any mother in the autism community if we'll take the flu, the measles, over autism any frickin' day of the week. So I think they need to wake up and stop hurting our kids.
McCarthy isn't trained in medicine, virology, or pharmacology. She's a Playboy playmate turned TV personality. But her son, Evan, had been diagnosed with autism, and she's a blonde bombshell. For newsrooms, especially TV newsrooms, this was in every sense a no-brainer. And McCarthy was invited to peddle the dangerous vaccines canard far and wide. Here she was on Oprah explaining why medical experts are wrong and she is right.
My science is named Evan, and he's at home. That's my science.
In the past 5 years, Wakefield himself lost his license to practice medicine, and not a single scientific study has located any correlation whatsoever between vaccines and autism. But the myth persists. And why? Because, though the science is unequivocal, the media are not.
The U.S. measles outbreak and the vaccine controversy, parents, doctors, even politicians now weighing in on both sides.
First on the rundown this morning, the escalating number of measles cases and the growing debate over vaccinations. It's turning into a full-fledged political firestorm.
As the measles outbreak spreads to 14 states across the country, the debate over vaccinations intensifies.
Those clips aren't from 1998. They are from this week. For crying out loud, there is no controversy. There is no debate. Cynical politicians like Rand Paul and Chris Christie may pander all they want to frightened moms and the tinfoil hat crowd, just as 49 U.S. senators can deny man's role in climate change. But there is no rational basis for their beliefs. They are simply wrong. And when the media frames such idiocy as one side of a debate, they are not only legitimizing ignorance and demagoguery, they are threatening the lives of children. Here's the thing about reality. It doesn't care what your opinion is. It doesn't care what your ideology is. It doesn't care what you believe in your heart. It doesn't care what a website says, and it doesn't even care what a majority of Americans think is true. Reality just is. It can't be balanced by lies, superstition, or even true conviction. And any attempt to do so courts catastrophe by aiding and abetting very dangerous fools. Coming up, the Church of Scientology versus RottenTomatoes.com. This is On the Media.
This is Brooke. When you've finished listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie about Pop-Tarts.
Did you really like Pop-Tarts all that much growing up?
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Still, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I love them.
That's a good breakfast for you?
I eat it after a bad show on a Wednesday night.
Listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last week at the Sundance Film Festival, debuted a documentary based on the book by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. The film version of Going Clear, by Oscar-winning documentarian Alex Gibney, will appear on HBO on March 16th. Here's a clip from the film in which two former members describe the conditions of a secret Scientology compound in California nicknamed The Hole.
The doors had bars put on them, the windows all had bars put on them, and there was one entrance door that a security guard sat at 24 hours a day.
I had to stay there, sleep there. It stunk, and you know, there were ants crawling around. You sleep about an hour, 2 hours a night. You were in such a mental state that you're very controllable, very suggestible.
Needless to say, the movie is causing some consternation at Scientology HQ, which for the first time will be facing major scrutiny at cinematic scale. We'll shortly get to the particulars of how the church has been dealing with that scrutiny. But first, an interview we did a couple of years back with Lawrence Wright about the Church of Scientology, which his book characterized less as a religious institution than as a cult shakedown racket and brutal security state. Still, Scientology boasts members the world over and assets exceeding $1 billion, despite a theology that sounds like the stuff of science fiction. In fact, it is the stuff of science fiction, as imagined by its founder, the late sci-fi writer L. Ron Hubbard. Some know Scientology as a sort of celebrity religion practiced by the likes of John Travolta, Kirstie Alley, and Tom Cruise. But any way you look at it, the church is so much more. Larry, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to be with you.
Now, most religions, as you observe in the book, are based on founding myths. And I suppose the overlord Xenu of the Galactic Confederacy 75 million years ago is no more implausible than Noah's Ark or the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And you take pains to point that out in the book. That said, you've also made very clear that the founding myths of Scientology, as promulgated by L. Ron Hubbard, are based on lies. His claims about the supernatural benefits of what he called Dianetics hinge on an utterly fabricated autobiography. I mean, it might be hard to fact-check Noah's Ark, but Hubbard left a paper trail.
Yeah, new religions do have a bar to jump over. in the case of his military service, this whole mythology about him wounded, crippled, and blinded, and left in a hospital without any hope, and he cured himself using techniques that he later refined into Dianetics. There's no evidence that he was injured in the war. The official records say he had conjunctivitis, but they're nothing serious. So him healing himself and developing these techniques seems to be based on his own imagination.
To give context as to why we'd even be having a conversation about how individuals practice their faith, we're not simply talking about spiritual matters here. In your book, you have documented what has long been rumored, and that's violence against and imprisonment of members for infractions real and imagined.
I had 12 people tell me that they were beaten by the leader of the church, David Miscavige, and more than 20 who witnessed such abuses. Oftentimes, the executives were dragged off to involuntary confinement in these re-education camps with nothing, no furniture. They slept on the floor. It was infested by ants. And some were confined there for years on end.
You're not the first journalist to delve into Scientology. The St. Petersburg Times, now the Tampa Bay Times, did it. The Los Angeles Times did it. Time Magazine. And an author named Paulette Cooper.
She was the very first to do an expose of Scientology in the middle 70s. And the church harassed her. They framed her for threatening the president with assassination and threatening the church with a bomb threat. It was all phony. But they got her indicted. And it wasn't until the FBI raided the church in 1977 and found a file called Operation Freakout that they discovered that there was a plan all along to drive Paulette Cooper insane or to get her locked up and imprisoned.
Operation Freakout, the dirty tricks and the harassment of Cooper, foreshadowed another initiative of breathtaking or stomach-turning scope. Tell me about Operation Snow White.
L. Ron Hubbard was paranoid about the information that the government was amassing on Scientology at the time. So he ordered his wife, Mary Sue Hubbard, who was in charge of what was called the Guardian's Office, that was their sort of secret police and CIA, to infiltrate organs of American government and foreign governments, and also Washington Post, other newspapers. They infiltrated the IRS, the FBI, the Justice Department. They infiltrated the American Psychological and Psychiatric Associations.
With moles, members as employees.
Yeah, more than 5,000 people were employed in this effort to gain control of all the pertinent information about Scientology, either steal it or change it or just bring it to the awareness of the church.
Throughout the book, you employ neutral language. You keep your cool, even when you're writing about David Miscavige, who comes off as a violent sociopath. And you're equally detached sounding when you write about L. Ron Hubbard himself, despite the lies and the paranoia that you also describe. But there is this one character in the book who just can't escape your opprobrium, and that's Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise on Tom Cruise, Scientologist.
I think it's a privilege to call yourself a Scientologist, and it's something that you have to earn.
The church was always looking for an exemplary figure that would represent Scientology to the world, a shining celebrity that would give credibility and attention to the church. He's their symbol. He's the most important Scientologist, except L. Ron Hubbard, there ever has been. He's their main pitchman. It's his close friend, David Miscavige, who runs the church. It's Tom Cruise who benefits materially from the labor of these impoverished Sea Org workers who have built him an airplane hangar for his airplane collection and handcrafted a limousine for him and surround his household staff and cook his dinners.
And if you're right, pimping him a girlfriend.
You know, he was breaking up with Penelope Cruz, and he let it be known that he wanted another girlfriend. And they auditioned a number of different Scientology women, and they came upon a very attractive Iranian-American. Her name was Nazanin Boniandi. And they told her that they had a mission for her. And they put her in the Celebrity Center away from her family, and they took her shopping in Beverly Hills for a new wardrobe. They fixed her hair. They fixed her teeth. And then they took her to New York. There she found the object of her mission was Tom Cruise. She moved in with him, lived with him for a while, and then went in with him in his hideaway in Telluride. David Miscavige and his wife came, and one night they were talking, and Miscavige speaks in a kind of rapid Philadelphia brogue, and she couldn't quite understand him, so she a couple of times asked him to repeat himself. And the next day, everybody was inflamed with her, the way she treated the leader of the church. And after that, Cruise decided to have nothing more to do with her. And she went off to Clearwater, Florida, the spiritual headquarters. She was made to clean out a garbage dumpster and clean a public toilet with a toothbrush.
You observe in the book that the fate of the Church of Scientology hinges on its staying in good graces with the Internal Revenue Service, which gets to determine whether an organization is a bona fide tax-exempt religion. At the moment, the IRS is copacetic with David Miscavige and penal punishments and harassment and violence.
That tax exemption was granted in 1993. The Church of Scientology at the time was $1 billion in arrears on its past taxes. It just decided not to pay taxes, and it had to get a tax exemption or it would go out of business. So they launched 2,400 lawsuits against the IRS and individual agents. They had private investigators trailing agents to see who drank too much, who was fooling around, and they published personal stories smearing the character of people that were working for the agency.
Now, it's one thing to bully an author, and another thing to bully apostates. But the IRS? The IRS? How do you manhandle the IRS?
It's amazing to think about that this rather small organization could bring the IRS to heel, but they really were intimidated by Scientology. So the deal was that those lawsuits would stop and those personal stories would stop, and the church gained its exemption. And once that happened, the vast protections of the First Amendment encompassed the church and its behavior.
The church has been remarkably successful in kind of battening down the hatches, but there was a very revelatory leak in 1985.
There was a lawsuit in the middle 80s, and all of the most protected secrets of the church's cosmology, the whole business about Xenu, the galactic overlord, and the space aliens that inhabit your body and so on, all of that was dumped into the court record. When the judge announced that this material was actually going to be made available, there were 1,500 Scientologists lined up in the courthouse to block everybody else from gaining access to these records.
Kind of a human denial of service attack.
Yeah, it's exactly the case. But unfortunately for them, the Los Angeles Times did obtain a copy and published a summary in the paper to the astonishment of the whole world when they began to read about it.
Scientology seems to have two main boogeymen. One is psychiatry, for some reason, and the second is the media, which they believe are, you know, as a monolith against their religion. I don't recall ever reading anything good about Scientology. Are they onto something?
I agree that Scientology is the most stigmatized religion in the country. Largely, I think, because of their own efforts and their own behavior. I didn't really set out to write an expose of Scientology. What I really wanted to do was understand it. And in the process of that, I met with a lot of hostility and resistance on the part of the church. But the facts are what they are.
Larry, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Lawrence Wright is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. True to form, the Church of Scientology has launched an aggressive PR campaign to discredit Going Clear, the movie, including a new category of targets for PR spin. Jason Bailey is neither a religion beat reporter or a muckraker. He's a film critic for FlavorWire.com. And last week, after publishing a glowing review of Going Clear, he found himself fending off the Scientology image complex.
4 hours after that review went live on FlavorWire, our editorial director received an email from the PR director for the Church of Scientology. And it informed us that that article was posted without contacting the church for comment. And it reflects the film, which is filled with, quote, bald-faced lies. And they asked that we included a statement from the church in our article because there is another side of the story and we shouldn't be a mouthpiece for Alex Gibney's propaganda. And it then included, you know, about a 200-word statement that told us how false the film was and that it was Rolling Stone UVA Redux and so on and so on.
Rolling Stone UVA, the now discredited story of a gang rape on the campus of the University of Virginia. I suppose they could be right. Going clear could be a tissue of lies. But you didn't write Going Clear.
I did
you
not.
You wrote a review of the movie.
Right.
What?
Well, and as I started poking around on Twitter with that same what response, I discovered that, in fact, it appeared that all of my colleagues who had reviewed Going Clear at Sundance had received the same email. And some of them even ran the response either, you know, sort of free of context or in the form of a, hey, Scientology sent us this statement sort of thing.
This piqued your curiosity, so you started digging around more. Tell me about the scope of the PR campaign. What did you learn?
Well, before I had even run the review, I had noticed that there were these tweets appearing in my Twitter timeline promoted from something called Freedom Media Ethics. Freedom Magazine is mentioned occasionally in the film. It's apparently the official sort of PR publication for the Church of Scientology. But this was an account that clearly had been set up specifically to combat the film. It's just this sort of rolling series of accusations against the film, accusations against Alex Gibney, apparently coupled with a very aggressive Google ad buy. As of Wednesday, as we're speaking, if you Google Going Clear, Going Clear documentary, HBO Scientology, any combination of names or phrases that have anything to do with this film. Heck, I Googled Bob Garfield Going Clear, and the top response directs you to the webpage on the Freedom Magazine website that is all about the film and what a bundle of lies it is. And only at the very bottom of that page do you see that it is affiliated with the Church of Scientology. You know, if you see the Google hit, it doesn't say any of that. It just says, get the facts about Alex Gibney's new movie. And it looks fairly innocuous unless you notice the little ad icon right next to it.
That's interesting because whether you are a perfectly respectable religion that has been unfairly besmirched or a continuing criminal enterprise that has been uncovered, there's some risk to fighting back like this because the very process just creates more attention for the film.
Right. There are a lot of people who will at least have their curiosity piqued to a degree that they would want to see the film. It's all very bizarre, but it is interesting to note that while it is an aggressive campaign, it is a campaign that is not being conducted in an out front method. They're sort of tipping around and emailing journalists. They're doing these promoted tweets that are not directly tied at first glance. They're doing these ads that are not directly tied at first glance because they're aware that the church's image is not the best right now. You know, there have been a few years of murmurs and chatter, and Wright's book was fairly well covered. And what's interesting about all of this is how neatly this response fits in with the film's image of them as being hyper-paranoid, super-controlling, and basically going after anyone who dares speak ill against them.
Now, a minute or two ago, I kind of laughed off the notion of asking a film critic to provide an alternate point of view in his or her review of a film. Mm-hmm. But in a case like this, when a film critic goes to review a documentary where the filmmaker clearly has a point of view and an agenda and is an activist or an advocate, whether you have to, you know, bone up and follow up in a way that you wouldn't if you were going to review a romantic comedy.
It's an interesting point, and I think a lot of it has to do with what kind of a film critic you are. I think it has a lot to do with what kind of a publication you're writing for. If documentary is your specialty, if you're writing for an academic journal as opposed to like a pop culture blog like I do. But the film critic's primary job is to discuss how a film works as a film, and certainly to be very careful to make clear that this is an activist film, this is an opinion film, it alleges these things. But what it comes down to, I think, is for someone with my job, it's mostly the responsibility to view it as a film, to view it as a work of art.
Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
Jason Bailey is the films editor for FlavorWire.com and the author of The Ultimate Woody Allen Film Companion.
L. Ron Hubbard did an amazing thing telling the world this incredible truth. Now all we're asking you to do is pick up where he left off.
But I don't know any of this stuff.
Neither did L. Ron when he started. He said he just closed his eyes and wrote down whatever came to mind. You can do the same. Just let it flow.
Okay, I'll try. I just wish I could write in my room, but Tom Cruise won't come out of the closet.
I know. We've sent Nicole Kidman up there to see if she can help.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sara Abdurkhman, Laura Mayer, Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, and Kasia Mihailovich. We had more help from Reem Abdu and Jesse Brenneman, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was David Grinbaum. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield. But before we go, an apology. On this broadcast last year, in an attempt to commemorate the outbreak of World War I and honor those brave souls who made the ultimate sacrifice, I recounted my personal eyewitnessing in 1914 of the Sarajevo assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. This was a bungled attempt to give heroes their due and a terrible mistake. Somehow I conflated my visit to the 2012 Sarajevo Film Festival and my ninth grade history curriculum. Similarly, contrary to what I might have casually mentioned on the Letterman show, I was not technically in the command module of the crippled Apollo 13. Turns out that was someone else. I unreservedly apologize for any confusion I may have caused.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.